All right. Welcome back, everyone. Is anyone here for the first time? You haven't been here? Okay, a number here for the first time. Okay. We have had a wonderful time. Well, I've had a wonderful time. I enjoy speaking. I don't know. I hope everybody else has had a wonderful time as well. We started off on Wednesday evening just kind of with an introductory session, creation evolution, what's it all about? Talking about the creation evolution issue and Genesis, how we as Christians need to understand Genesis, whether or not we can interpret it in different ways and so on, and some details about the age of the earth, and we'll go into more details tomorrow night on that, and the fossils and millions of years and so on. We put all those ideas together and talked about the relationship between faith and science and those things. Then last night was our biology night. So last night we talked about animals changing over time and the idea that that's not evolution. We talked about the wonderful poodle and other things like that. If you were here last night, you know about that. But tonight is our astronomy night. Tonight we're talking about astronomy, the Big Bang, the formation of the large-scale structure of the universe. That's what we're talking about tonight. And oftentimes people think, well, okay, yes, God created living things and He created them recently. And then when someone says, well, yeah, the Big Bang's not true either, people think, well, wait a minute. Everybody believes in the Big Bang. I mean, God must have worked through that somehow. The Big Bang is everybody believes that, don't they? All the scientists support that. Well, that's what we're here to look at tonight. Is the Big Bang something that we should be basing our belief system on, and something that we should be integrating with the biblical text? Creationist view of astronomy. Who gets the glory for the amazing universe we see today? Father God or Mother Nature? And a lot of people today, a lot of people who are into environment, to preserving the environment, and there's a whole global warming camp that's their big issue in life. They feel that if the temperature on Earth goes up, it's going to be catastrophic. Most of those folks are evolutionists. They're not believers. And their belief is that the Earth is sacred. The Earth is Mother Earth. The universe wants to produce life. There are these kinds of ideas, kind of New Age ideas. Spiritualism floats around often in the extremists, the environmental extremists. They feel that Mother Nature should get the credit for all of the wonderful things that we see. For the birds flying and for all of life and for the amazing complexities of the universe. It's no God. It's nature, it's evolution that has produced all of this. Wow, isn't evolution amazing? And you hear terminology like that. Now, for those of you who weren't here when we started, there was a number of hands up. I'm from Creation Ministries, and there's a picture of my family. That was taken, that's a couple of years ago now. There's my wife Karen there and our daughters. And at the time that this picture was taken, Fangrad number 6 was right there inside Mom. And she's now 1 year old. Megan is our youngest. I've got 4 girls. I'm beautifying the world by having girls, right? That's my story anyways. I also mentioned when we got started there initially on Wednesday night, I mentioned that as a ministry, our focus is on getting information, faith-building information, out into the church. Our goal as a ministry with these speaking events is we want to reach every church in Canada. And we've got 7 other offices in 7 other countries around the world. Well, 6 other countries, 7 altogether, including Canada. And each of them has their speaking staff, and they want to reach all the churches in their area, in their country. And, well, I mean, that's a goal that we have. We'll probably never get there. But we've got 4 speakers in Canada. I'm 1 of 4. And the Canadian office started as a room in my home in late 98. And I've been speaking on this now for, since 94, since late 94. We have a number of tools that we've developed as a ministry to get information out into the church. You walk by some of them at the back there. Resources, books, DVDs. We've got a magazine called Creation Magazine. That is probably the number one resource that equips people, builds their faith, and ends up changing their lives. And that's not just me saying that. the testimonies of subscribers. It's the subscribers to the magazine that tell us that. They tell us of everything that you guys do. It's the magazine that had the biggest impact on my life. And over again, everywhere we travel, you know what? Your magazine had a huge impact on my life. I'm one of those testimonies. The magazine had a huge impact on my life. And anyways, we've gone on to develop other things like a website. That's what our website looks like. And you can do a search if you've got questions about all kinds of things. There's a little search area up here. There's also a topics page. You can go to this answers button here. It's called topics now. And that'll take you to an alphabetized listing of topics. Archaeology, aliens, you know, did God create life on other planets? And plate tectonics, natural selection, genetics, astronomy, astrophysics, all kinds of different things. And that's the gateway to more than 7,500 articles on that website. It's a huge, huge resource, and it's all free. Our goal is to get information out into the church. I mentioned the website name, creation.com. Simple, easy to remember. I mean, if you're going to the internet looking for information on creation, to something to try to answer questions that you may have about Genesis, that's about the simplest website that you can think of. We've got an email news as well called InfoBytes, and there's sign-up sheets at the back. This is an email news that you can sign up for to stay informed. As a Christian, there are often news reports out there by scientists, by researchers out there, and they're finding things that are always written up. They're always written up this way. It's evidence for evolution. Rarely in the media do you have a scientist writing something, I found this new discovery, and you know what? It supports the Bible. How often do you read that online or wherever you get your news, if you get a newspaper? You don't get it a lot. That's what we try to provide with some of these InfoBytes, the Christian perspective on that. That's why we employ scholars and scientists. I said this already on Wednesday night. As a Christian organization, we're a little bit different than other Christian organizations because we employ PhD scientists. And of all the Christian groups that are out there, we employ the most PhD scientists. And it's not just the guys on our staff. We work with a worldwide community of Bible-believing Christian men and women who are involved in science and research. We work with those folks. And there's some sign-up sheets at the back. If you didn't sign up on Wednesday, there's some sign-up sheets at the back. You can get yourself on that list. And that's a way that you can stay informed as a Christian. Parenting is primarily an evangelistic activity. Would you agree? That's a quote actually from John MacArthur. And yet, some statistics, and again, this is a bit of a review from Wednesday night. There's huge percentages of Christian children leaving the church. There are some of the percentages from recent studies that have been done. 88% down south in America in the Southern Baptist Convention. The largest denomination of churches in the U.S. is the Southern Baptist Convention. And they're finding that nearly 1 in 10 of their kids are leaving Christianity when they get late high school, university, and so on. Start hearing about evolution, that type of thing. And we talked about reasons for that, and I showed this on Wednesday night, and I kind of picture this as the inside of perhaps little Johnny or little Susie's head when they're 3 years old and going to church with a Christian mom and dad, and they hear stories in Sunday school about Jesus' miracles and about Paul's missionary journeys and Abraham and Isaac and all of the history that's there in the Bible, Noah and the flood, Jonah and the great fish. But then they go to school or they get a little old, they read an article on the internet or newspaper or whatever. Mom and dad, do dinosaurs fit with the Bible? And most parents have difficulty answering that question. I mean, parents, kids are fascinated with dinosaurs. You've got to know the answer to how they fit into the Bible. Otherwise, what happens with little Johnny or little Susie? That question doesn't get answered. And then another question comes along. Where do the ice ages fit into the Bible? There was at least one. There's good evidence that there was an ice age. Where does it fit into the Bible? And where did the water come from for the flood? How can you cover the earth, all the high mountains under the whole heavens? And we'll talk about that in one of the sessions coming up. We're doing a session on Noah's flood. But most people can't answer that question. And kids grow up, and they get more and more and more of these questions. Where did God come from? Do animals change over time? Isn't that evolution? What about different skin colors? Did God create evil? How did people live so long before the flood? And as the weeks go on, the inside of little Johnny or little Susie's head looks like that. And it's a mess. And that's why they leave the church. I think there's other reasons as well, but that's a major reason. As parents, as Christian parents, our primary activity is evangelistic. We're to evangelize our own kids as a primary activity. So creation by God or the Big Bang? That's the question this evening. Let's get into that. That was the review, and we'll get into the Big Bang here versus God. The Big Bang is not compatible with the Bible. That's the first statement that we can make. It doesn't fit with the Bible. And again, this is talked about this a little bit, very briefly on Wednesday when we started. The Bible says the earth was initially a universal ocean, and dry land came after that, came on day three. But the Big Bang says, no. The earth was a hot, molten blob that cooled down, and millions of years later came water. So you've got the history of the earth via the Big Bang in a certain way, and then you've got the history of the earth as described in the Bible, and they don't fit. And there's many other incompatibilities. And in the session tomorrow night, we'll talk about some of the other incompatibilities. However, the Big Bang is also not compatible with science. It doesn't fit with the Bible, and it doesn't fit with science. And I'll tell you about some of that. First of all, it's not about observations. This, again, is a bit of a review. Creationists accept all observations that evolutionists make. We're looking through the same telescopes. We're seeing the same things in the heavens that the evolutionists make. The facts are all the same. It's about interpretation. We understand them differently. We interpret them differently. We'll interpret them according to that biblical history, because we know that that history is true. The evolutionists, on the other hand, they know that the Big Bang is true. So when they see something, they'll fit it into that history when they explain it. And one of the tools, of course, that astronomers use is the Hubble telescope. And there's many other powerful telescopes out there. The Hubble is an amazing machine. Just incredible. Now, some of you, if you've heard about the Hubble telescope, you likely also heard that when it was launched and first brought up to power and the first images came, there was great disappointment because they were fuzzy. And so they had to use complicated software to try and make it better. But then there was a repair mission. Astronauts went up on the shuttle and they repaired it. This is one of the pictures from before the optical repair. They switched some things out. And this is after. See the difference there? Pretty astounding, isn't it? It's the same galaxy before and after. But that's an observation. We're observing that spiral galaxy called M100 there. Observation. The Hubble Deep Field image. This is an amazing observation that was made by the Hubble telescope, the Hubble Deep Field image. Now, what is that? Okay, well, the Hubble was pointed to an empty area of sky, relatively empty, no stars there, no nothing there, and it was pointed there for many days, and it's like taking a picture, you put your camera on a tripod at night, and you leave the shutter open for a long time. And then when you get the picture, you can see that the lights that were very dim actually expose quite well if you leave the shutter open long enough. Well, the Hubble was pointed at a dark area of sky where there's no stars, and the shutter was left open for a very, very long time, like you would do if you're a photographer taking pictures at night. And so it was pointed to an area just above the Big Dipper there, and that little shape there in the middle, that's the shape of the picture it took. And just to give you an idea of the size of the section of sky that it was taking, it wasn't a wide angle picture. It was a very, very narrow part of the sky. If the moon, there's the moon for reference. So it's a very, very small part of the sky. Hubble Deep Field image, there's the image that was produced. Every point of light is a galaxy of about 100 million stars. Every point of light that you see there. There's about 3,000 galaxies in this image. And every single one of those points of light is a galaxy of about 100 million stars. It's believed to be representative of the whole sky. In other words, that's probably the same as everywhere around us. It would take 500,000 images, 500,000 images of that size to cover the entire sky. There's the faintest light is 4 billion times fainter than can be seen with the eye. So that there's some galaxies very, very far away. Very, very faint galaxies. Hubble Deep Field Image. The question is the Big Bang the only possible explanation for these observations? That's the way it was written up. This amazing image was made public and scientists started writing it up. Nobody really talked about it. There was a few creationists that talked about it, but generally it was evolution. Wow, isn't this amazing? But there were some problems with it. And creationists started pointing out the problems. See, light takes time to get to us. This is a picture of a sunset. This picture shows what the sun looked like 8 minutes ago. It takes 8 light minutes for light to get from the sun to us. It's not instant. It takes 8 minutes. Traveling at the speed of light, it takes 8 minutes to get from the sun to the earth. So that's a picture of what the sun looked like 8 minutes ago. Not right now. When you see a sunset and the sun is just about to set, in reality, it's already below the horizon. But we're only seeing the light 8 minutes later. The Hubble Deep Field Image, we are seeing, in that image, we're seeing the galaxies as they appeared 12 billion years ago. Some of those galaxies are so far away that at the speed of light, it would take 12 billion years for the light to get here. Now, that's according to evolutionists, right? Obviously, that's an evolutionary estimate. Now, here's the problem. Here are the various interpretations. Here, the problem for the Big Bang is a lot of those galaxies in that image are mature galaxies. It takes quite a while to get to that configuration of stars circling around the center of the galaxy. And yet, that's not that long after the Big Bang. The Big Bang, they're saying, is about 13.75 billion years ago. And so the Hubble is now looking back to what the universe was like 12 billion years ago, and you're seeing mature, old galaxies. But that can't be. For the evolutionists, this is a problem. Galaxies take billions of years to get to the stage that the Hubble Deep Field was seeing those galaxies at. It's a problem. The galaxies shouldn't be that mature yet. They should be young galaxies just starting to form. The stars coming together, the things starting to swirl around and so on. But they're mature galaxies. That's a problem. One of the evolutionary astronomers says this: it leaves an uncomfortably short time for galaxies to form after the origin of the universe itself. That's an evolutionist speaking there. Here's what another evolutionary scientist says. In the Big Bang model, the vast majority of galaxies are relatively late bloomers, taking many billions of years to pack on enough mass either by pulling in gas from the surrounding intergalactic medium or merging with neighboring galaxies. The standard model still can't easily account for a large number of mature or massive galaxies in the early universe. Evolutionists have a problem. With their particular understanding, 12 billion years, etc., etc., they've kind of painted themselves into a corner. There are other interpretations for the Hubble Deep Field, aren't there? And we explored this yesterday and especially when we started on Wednesday. And here's another interpretation: creation. As we read in Scripture, God created a fully functional universe with mature people, animals, plants, stars, and galaxies right at the beginning. I don't have a problem with mature galaxies that far out. God created a fully functional universe. And then people say, well, wait a minute, didn't God create things with the appearance of age? Has anybody ever heard that phrase before, the appearance of age? God created with the appearance of age? Yeah. Let's just take a bit of a rabbit trail here. There's a difference between God creating a fully functional universe and a universe with the appearance of age. We used to say that. Well, God created things with the appearance of age, and so you've got rocks in the ground that look like they're millions of years old, but they're really not, and because God created them that way. There's problems with that interpretation, because if you really get into the specifics, you wind up with God being deceptive, which is, of course, not God. God is a God of love. He's the truth. God is not deceptive. And here's the difference between God creating with the appearance of age or creating a functionally complete universe. Or the appearance of age. People say, well, Adam was, he was mature. He was maybe, you know, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, something like that. So he started off as a young adult, something like that, not a little person. But if you could somehow measure Adam, if you had something that could measure how old his body is on day seven, well, you'd say, wait a minute, this guy's one day old, and yet he's fully grown. But it's fully complete, but his body's young. Here's another example to make it easier to understand. Let's say that on day six of creation, Adam wants to be romantic with Eve. The sun's going down, beautiful sunset there, and so he wants to build a campfire for Eve and roast some marshmallows or something. And so he goes into the nearest redwood forest with his chainsaw and cuts down an 8-foot diameter redwood tree, right? And he wants to build a nice fire. And if God created with the appearance of age, you would see tree rings there, but there wouldn't be tree rings. God could build a completely functional redwood tree without the appearance of age. There's the difference. Rings in trees are representative of the annual variation in growth. In the wintertime, you get the dense areas produced. In the summertime, it grows. So if Adam would have seen rings there, he may have thought, well, wait a minute. You know, God told me that plants were created on day three. How come I'm seeing here a seasonal variation of hundreds of years in this redwood tree? Something's not right. Did you see the difference? Creating with the appearance of age, which God did not do, versus a fully functional, fully complete created universe. And so that comes into play in astronomy as well. There's a biological example with a tree. But you can see the difference between those two terms. We've moved over the years away from talking about the appearance of age as Christians, as creationists. Rather, God created a functionally complete universe. Now, it comes into play a little bit in this with these galaxies here. The light from most galaxies is redshifted. Has anyone heard that term before? You have the redshift from light? Okay, a few people. All right, so let's explain what that means. What is redshift? If you have a wavelength of light, here's light being transmitted along, and you stretch it out, it moves to the red end of the spectrum. Now, it's a lower frequency. So it shifts in color, essentially. You have different color bands. There's the visible spectrum there. That's what we can perceive with our eyes. Here's high frequency up here, ultraviolet, blue, and blues, and so on. And then down at the other end, that's lower frequency, shorter wavelength. So if you take light, a wave of light, and you stretch that light out, it becomes slower. It becomes a longer wavelength. And so you're moving it from the higher frequency, or the different colors up there, down to the red end of the spectrum, hence redshift. The light from galaxies very, very far away has been stretched. It's been manipulated to shift to the red end of the spectrum. Whenever something burns, here's hydrogen. And when you burn hydrogen in a lab, it emits these particular frequencies of light. And those combine to produce a kind of a pinkish glow. And if you combine these frequencies here. And in the telescopes, if you put a little spectrum analyzer on the end of your telescopes, you can tell what elements are burning within that star, or what are the primary elements that are burning within a particular galaxy. And when you see this, here's the signature of hydrogen, but look at this. It should be here, but it's here. It's been shifted toward the red end of the spectrum. That's what astronomers are seeing in the great majority of galaxies, a red shift. You can also have blue shift. That's hydrogen and other elements like helium and so on. When it burns, they have different spectral lines. And so you can recognize, it's like a fingerprint when you burn a particular element. That's hydrogen and it's been blue shifted. It's over that way. That's what astronomers are seeing. Mostly red shift, some blue shift. So how does that relate into the observations here? The light from most galaxies is redshifted. The evolutionists have an interpretation. The redshift is due to the motion of galaxies away from us. So it's a Doppler effect. It's because of motion. The stretching is because the galaxies are moving away from us, And the faster they move away, the more that light is stretched. It leaves the galaxy at a particular frequency, but because it's moving so fast, it ends up looking like it's been stretched out. It's a lower frequency. Now, there's another interpretation. The redshift is due to the stretching of space. Now, that is... And in reality, there's absolutely no way to tell what was the cause of the redshift. It was either one or two. There's no way to test the difference between those two. It could have been either. Now, creationists are favoring the second explanation. Why? Well, in quite a number of places in the Bible, there's verses mentioning the stretching of space. You've got there in Job, he alone who stretches out the heavens. He stretches out the heavens like a tent. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy. He who created the heavens and the earth, or the heavens, and stretched them out. You've got this stretching or spreading of the heavens. Well, if you have, let's say you have a sheet of rubber or a balloon or something, and you write a wavelength on it. Well, if you stretch out the space on which that wave is traveling, and getting in this case the rubber, you lower the frequency, don't you? It's a type of redshift. It's a way to produce the redshift. And so creationists have an explanation, and that explanation is actually far superior to explaining the things that we see in the heavens. And it ends up producing a young universe. Then you don't need the millions of years to get to the galaxies and so on. But, I can prove that the universe is young. I found this, actually, on the Internet. And you can trust everything that's on the Internet, by the way. Here's the how and when did the universe begin? Well, there's a birth certificate. Can you imagine? Look at that. The universe, born, the beginning of time, certificate number Genesis 1:1. That proves it, doesn't it? But that leads into kind of an interesting question. Which is more accurate, an estimate or a measurement? Obviously a measurement, right? Well, the Bible gives us a measured time scale, an eyewitness record of history, a far more accurate foundation, a secure foundation, than any modern scientific estimate. All science can do is make estimates into the past. You can't observe the past. You make estimates. You make a story about when a particular event happened, like the formation of the universe, the Big Bang, and so on. But if you have a written account, like a birth certificate, which is essentially what the Bible is, then you have a more sure record, a more sure, you've got a measurement, essentially, of that time. And how do we get to, I mentioned this on, what would have been on Wednesday, I mentioned 6,000 years, the Earth's about 6,000 years old. How do we get there? Let's do that quickly. Ask any archaeologist when Abraham lived, and they'll tell you Abraham was born around 2000 BC. Well, in Genesis 5 and Genesis 11, we've got what are called chronogenealogies. Not just genealogies, but they have the chronology, the time in there as well. Chronogenealogies. So you have the time between this guy and when his son was born, and when his son was born, and when his son was born. The exact year, we actually have the exact year between the birth of Abraham and the creation of Adam, back on day 6. It's 2009 years. And so if you just do some basic math, and you get to around 4,000 years ago. And yet we've got some things in the heavens that astronomers are telling us take millions of years. But here are some other problems with the Big Bang. You cannot get from gas to solid objects like dust. An expanding cloud of gas will not reverse its expansion and collapse into solid objects. This is a huge problem for the Big Bang. The Big Bang starts with a whole bunch of energy, and then the next stage is some of that energy is converted into matter, hydrogen, perhaps some helium, they say. But it's hydrogen and helium gas. And after the gas, the way the story goes is, the gas has to coalesce to form solid particles, dust, essentially. You can't, the first thing is you can't get from gas to solid objects like dust. At that point, the Big Bang is nonsense. But it doesn't stop there. At every stage in the supposed Big Bang, it doesn't work scientifically. You cannot get from dust to planets. The next step. If enough dust collects to form small pebbles, the pebbles will collide too quickly and begin to break each other up and turn themselves back into dust. So you've got another problem. If you could get from gas to dust and from dust to pebbles, then the pebbles are going to turn themselves back into dust. And this is a huge problem. And evolutionists know about this problem. Here's an evolutionist talking about this. Once these planetesimals, or these asteroids, have been formed, further growth of planets may occur through their gravitational accretion into large bodies. Just how that takes place is not understood. What? Just how it takes place is not understood? That's not the way it's written up in the newspapers, is it? You don't hear that, oh, we're not sure about the Big Bang because we can't figure out how it would ever have gotten past this point. You never find that in the media, right? It's, oh, absolutely the Big Bang. It's science. There's so much science to back up the Big Bang. No, there's not. They can't figure out how to get from dust to gas. They can't figure out how to get from dust to planets, or from gas to dust, rather, and then from dust to planets. Here's another problem. They can't get from planets to stars. Star formation is perhaps the weakest link in stellar evolution theory. How did the universe, how did the stars evolve? Well, and that's the weakest link. Again, here's another evolutionist. Here's what he says. Abraham Loeb of Harvard Center for Astrophysics says, the truth is that we don't understand star formation at a fundamental level. What? I thought the Big Bang was something everybody believed, that there was loads of science behind it. Here's another problem for the Big Bang, a light travel problem. In 1964, it was discovered that the Earth was bathed in a faint microwave radiation, high-frequency radiation, apparently coming from the most distant observable regions of the universe. The cosmic microwave background, or CMB for short, comes from all directions in space and is essentially the same temperature or the same energy level everywhere. But it shouldn't be if the Big Bang is true. It should be a little different. Now this is early in the Big Bang, and you can see points A and B there. If the blue sections are a little cooler and the red sections are a little hotter, or the orange sections are a little hotter, they begin with different temperatures, and that's what Big Bang folks tell us. There would have been inconsistencies, little differences in the temperature. But then, as the expansion occurs, we're told that the universe expanded from the Big Bang and so on. Points A and B, at the speed of light, this hot area over here doesn't have enough time in the 13.75 billion year old universe. There isn't enough time for the light to travel to the cool areas to warm them up and balance them out. They're still hot and cool areas. That shouldn't be. And yet it is. That's a huge problem for the Big Bang. Here's some other problems for the Big Bang. According to the Big Bang, the universe began about 13.7 billion years ago. It has been slowly evolving ever since. If there is evidence that the heavenly objects are young and change quickly, this would be evidence against the Big Bang. The story of evolution is one of slow, gradual things. Slowly dust collapses into pebbles, and then slowly things come together. And there's a lot of evidence that heavenly objects are young, which is evidence against the Big Bang. Here's an example. Magnetic fields of planets and moons. The magnetic fields of some of these planets are way too strong. If they'd been in existence as long as the Big Bang says they have been, then the magnetic field should long ago have decayed to something not very large. Small planets and moons should have cooled down so that any liquid core would solidify, shutting down the evolutionist dynamo mechanism for the generation of a magnetic field. According to their own theory, they shouldn't have strong magnetic fields. Well, in 1984, Dr. Russell Humphreys predicted the field strengths of Uranus and Neptune, two of the planets at the edge of our solar system. His predictions were about 100,000 times different than the evolutionary predictions. The two rival models were put to the test when the Voyager 2 spacecraft flew by these two planets in 1986 and 1989, and the magnetic field strengths of those two planets were just as Dr. Humphreys predicted. He's a young Earth creationist. He knew that those planets were not that old. And so he started with the biblical framework to make those predictions. See, a good scientific method, a good scientific hypothesis, a theory, a good scientific theory will have explanatory power. You'll be able to use it to explain things. And Dr. Humphreys used a biblical model to make predictions to try to explain the magnetic fields of those planets. And so did the evolutionists. And which model ended up conforming with the observations? It was the biblical model that Dr. Humphreys, as a young Earth creationist, a physicist, developed. Here's another one. The Earth's magnetic field, our own magnetic field. There's a clear indication of an exponential decay in the Earth's magnetic field. It's been decaying. Well, that suggests that the Earth cannot be older than about 10,000 years. Because if you extrapolate that back, you get back to about 10 or 11 or 12, 13,000 years, something like that. And the magnetic field of the Earth would be so powerful that the Earth would begin to melt. You get a problem. According to the magnetic measurements made of the Earth and the rate at which our magnetic field is decaying, the Earth cannot possibly be older than about 10,000 years. So there's powerful evidence against the Big Bang. The Earth did not form from a dust cloud 4.6 billion years ago. It doesn't work. The moon, you look at the moon, here's another evidence against the Big Bang. The moon is young. The moon has been receding away from the Earth, getting further from the Earth, about 4 centimeters per year. It's not very far. But if the Earth and the moon are 4.6 billion years old, what evolutionists say, there just isn't enough time, there's way too much time there. It would only take about 1.4 billion years for the moon to get to its current distance. And yet evolutionists are saying, no, they're not 1.4, they're 4.6 billion years old. So there's a measurement that doesn't fit with the evolutionists' story of the formation of our solar system either. And here's another evidence. Many of the moons show incredible geologic activity. If evolution is true, they're telling us that these moons that circle around both the Earth and many of the other planets, you can see some of the moons in our solar system there that circle some of the other planets. There's our moon up at the top and some of the other ones there. To evolutionists, they should be old, cold, and dead. Any geologic activity, volcanoes and some plate tectonics and things like that, they should have long ago settled down. They should be old, cold, and dead. Well, what do we see? You go to Jupiter, and you find Jupiter's moon Io. There's a picture of Io just in front of Jupiter there behind it. It's about 1.5 times the size of Earth. There's a picture of Io when the Galileo mission in 89 circled very close to Io. That's kind of what it looks like. And that spacecraft recorded 80 active volcanoes on Io, some of the biggest volcanoes in the whole solar system, way bigger than anything on Earth. If those volcanoes had been erupting at only 10% of their currently observed rate, Io, in 4.6 billion years, the supposed age of the solar system, Io would have erupted its entire volume more than 40 times. If those volcanoes had been erupting at only 10% of the currently observed levels, Io is not old, cold, and dead. It's very, very active. It's young. It wasn't formed that long ago. It doesn't conform with the Big Bang. Here's another evidence. Comets. There's long-period comets and short-period comets. Now, evolutionists say that the comets were formed at the same time as the solar system, 4.6 billion years ago. But that can't be. The short-period comets, they go around the sun, and comets are basically, it's kind of like a slush ball. It's kind of like what you pick up on the side of the road now before they all melt away here in a few days. It's mostly ice and some dirt thrown in. That's basically what a comet is. And every time it goes around the sun, it loses quite a bit of itself. And comets can only make so many orbits before they all fizzle away. It's like springtime in Canada, right? They're not going to last that long. There's no way that comets can last 4.6 billion years. At the upper limit, it could be 10,000 years. If the solar system is older than 10,000 years, we should not be seeing these things anymore. And yet, there's a comet. So what's going on? Now, the evolutionists, they recognize these problems. They recognize this problem, and they've proposed a solution. They've said, well, there's the Oort cloud and the Kuiper belt. Now, there's some evidence that there is a Kuiper belt, and these are the birthplace of comets. But the Oort cloud, as an explanation, to birth new comets, and every once in a while it fires a new comet out there, so these comets are still being manufactured today. The problem with the Oort cloud is that there's absolutely no observational evidence for it. Nobody's ever seen it. It's a patch that the evolutionists have invented on one of their problems. But there's absolutely no observations for it. You know what? Science is based on observation. If you want to make up a story about the Oort cloud birthing comets every once in a while, talk about it in religion class. Don't bring it in the science class. Science involves observation. That's not observation. Here's another evidence that the Big Bang isn't true, and for the youth of the solar system. Saturn's rings are highly structured and have been widening rapidly. They would never have lasted billions of years. The spacecraft that flew by Saturn's rings, some of the rings are very thin, just little bands. Well, you can imagine, of course, that the little particles, that in some cases dust, in some cases larger boulders, have been colliding together for, if it's been 4.6 billion years, we shouldn't have the fine ring structure. It should just flatten out into a disk. It shouldn't have the detail that it still does if Saturn is 4.6 billion years old. But it can't be, because we wouldn't see the rings that we see today. Here's another evidence. Both Saturn and Jupiter radiate a lot more energy than they receive from the Sun, meaning that the planets are not old, cold, and dead. They were formed recently, and there's still the energy there from when God put that material together. They're not old, cold, and dead. It doesn't fit with evolution. They shouldn't be doing that if they're 4.6 billion years old. And then we started off by saying if we could find things in our telescopes that change quickly instead of changing slowly, well, here's an example of something that changed quickly. Fast-changing stars. There was this object called Sakurai's object. Sakurai was a Japanese astronomer, amateur astronomer, so they called this Sakurai's object, in Sagittarius, in that constellation in the sky. In 1994, it was first discovered it was a white dwarf. Now, what's a white dwarf? A white dwarf is like our sun. Its mass is comparable to that of our sun, but its volume is comparable to the Earth. So you've got all this matter that's the size of our sun, but it's compacted into something the size of our Earth. That's a white dwarf. Now, the observations in the following years astounded astronomers. In 1997, it was a bright yellow giant, about 80 times wider than the sun. So in 3 years, it goes to being about the size of the Earth, to now it's 80 times wider than the sun in 3 years. That's a fast-changing star. Then a year later, it was a red supergiant, about 150 times wider than the sun. Then in 2002, it shrank so that it was invisible to even the most powerful telescopes. There are things in the universe that don't conform to the Big Bang. Things change quickly, or they can change quickly. They don't change slowly. Here's another evidence that our galaxy is not millions of years old. What you're looking at here is a supernova remnant. A supernova is a star that has become unstable and exploded. And this is basically what you have left over after the explosion. You have the guts of the star that are expanding out into the neighboring area. And it produces, you have this gas and these beautiful colors and so on. Now, if you look at the supernova remnants in our galaxy, in the Milky Way galaxy, supernova remnants, and there's different stages of those. First stage, those are the youngest, and the third stage, those are the oldest, the very largest supernova remnants. Now, again, it's a scientific model, and a good model will be one that makes accurate predictions. So we've got the Big Bang model. If our galaxy is billions of years old, looking at the supernova remnants, there are the predictions about the number of supernovas we should see based on how often they happen nowadays. However, if the Bible is true and if our galaxy is only in the neighborhood of 6,000 to 7,000 years old, the predictions are very, very different. Very, very different. Now, what are the observations? There they are. What does it fit with? The Bible. It's a great time to be a Christian, isn't it? I said that last night, I think, once or twice. But look at this. there's the prediction, and you go out and look in your telescope, and you discover, hey, the Milky Way isn't billions of years old. There's no third-stage supernova remnants. If the Milky Way is billions of years old, there should be the majority of the supernovas should be supernova remnants. It should be the third-stage supernova remnants. There aren't any in the Milky Way. Amazing. Now, I've spent some time talking about the Earth being young and things like that. I'm going to change gears a little bit. So just before you start throwing stuff at me, I'll explain this as we go on here. What you're looking at here is a collision of two galaxies. These galaxies are mostly empty space, and galaxies can move through each other. But they don't move through each other without affecting each other. The gravity in each one of those galaxies tears the galaxies apart. And that's what you see here. These galaxies have moved through each other, and this one is being torn apart. This one's, something's going on there. All this is being pulled this way, and you've got this thing shooting out over here. That can't happen in 6 or 7,000 years. That process takes millions of years. There you have another galaxy collision. And you have those galaxies being torn apart as the gravity affects different things. These activities take millions of years. Now remember, a few minutes ago, we talked about God creating a fully complete universe versus the appearance of age. Now here we're looking at something that can't take place. If God created two galaxies 6,000 years ago and then had them on a collision course and they moved through each other, that takes longer than 6,000 years. So how do we explain that? What I'm getting at is that way, way out in space, the universe could be millions or billions of years old. That's why I warned you not to start throwing things at me. The Earth is young. The Earth and the surrounding area, the Milky Way, we just talked about the Milky Way, is young. But there is good evidence that way, way out in space, toward the edge of the universe, it is actually millions and billions of years old. There's a book that I brought with me at the back there to back me up. I have an astrophysicist that backs me up, okay? One of our guys in Australia, Dr. John Hartnett, wrote this book a number of years ago. It's a fairly new book, actually. Starlight, Time, and the New Physics, to talk about some of these. He's an astrophysicist. In fact, he was in Washington, D.C. last year to pick up an award. He has patents. He builds the world's most accurate atomic clocks. And he's a young Earth creationist. He's associated with our Australian office. He speaks for our Australian office. And he wrote this book, Starlight, Time, and the New Physics. See, Einstein, yeah, have you heard of Albert Einstein and the theory of relativity? I'm sure most of you have. Einstein said, back in the early 1900s, he said that gravity affects time. In a stronger gravitational field, time slows down. And that's, I know that's mind-bending, but that's been experimentally verified many times. Time may be slower down here. You go up on a mountain, less gravity, you're further away from the center of the Earth. There's less gravity, time goes faster in a lesser gravitational field. It goes slower in a greater field. That's what Einstein predicted with his mathematics of general relativity. And that's been experimentally verified many times. Einstein was right. Gravity does affect time. How many of you have GPSs in your cars? I used the GPS to get here on Wednesday night. Now I know the way, but the GPS in your car, there's a clock in the GPS satellite, which is 20,000 kilometers above us. Now, the clock that runs in your GPS, that synchronizes with the clock in the satellite, because it's in a lesser gravitational field, the clock on the satellite is actually it's actually going faster by 43 microseconds per day. Now, you've heard that the faster you go as you approach the speed of light, time slows down. You've heard that as well? So that's what Einstein said first, actually. The faster you go, time slows down. But then a number of years later, in his general theory of relativity, he added gravity into the equation. In a stronger gravitational field, time slows down. So you have to add 43 microseconds, and then because the satellite is traveling at about 12,000 kilometers per hour, you have to subtract 5 microseconds per day. So the net difference is the GPS clocks on these satellites run approximately 38 microseconds per day faster than Earth clocks, than the clocks in our GPSs. Now, what does that mean? Why does it matter? If the time difference was ignored and no compensation was made, the position errors in your GPS would build up at a rate of about 400 meters per hour. So when you switch on your GPS and you say, okay, I want to go to the farmer's market in St. Jacobs, every hour that your GPS is on, it would be off by 400 meters more. So this is real science. It's not just Einstein was who knows what was going on in his head or something. Einstein was on the right track. And this is part of real science today. The clocks in these satellites need to be adjusted so that they run slower, so that they run at the same speed as the clocks on the surface of the Earth. Otherwise, the GPS technology wouldn't work. Now, how does that... We talked about the stretching of space. God stretched out the heavens and that kind of thing. This whole question relates to how come we're seeing the light from those galaxies that are so far away and so on. And how can there be millions of years out there anyways? I'll give you a very... We're talking about relativity, so I'll give you a very summary, a kind of a nutshell answer. And then for those of you who want more details, come and see me afterwards, because we're going to lose just about everybody here, unless you've studied astrophysics. I pointed out those verses that God said he stretched out the heavens. Well, then before that stretching, that means that everything in the universe was closer together, doesn't it? And if the universe is not infinite, evolutionists believe the universe goes on forever in every direction. Kind of a nonsensical idea. It makes more sense that God is eternal, but the universe, his creation, is finite. That there is an edge to space. It does stop somewhere. If you simply accept that little assumption, and everything being closer together initially, if the Earth is near the middle of all of that matter, all the matter of the galaxies that we see today, before God stretched it out, then there would be a lot of gravity around the Earth. Whereas gravity way out here, where there's hardly any matter, gravity would be very little. So while minutes or seconds go by on Earth, it's possible that millions or billions of years could have elapsed at the edge of the universe. Plenty of time to get the light from those galaxies way out there to Earth in a short period of time. So there's, and I'll stop it there. Some of you are smiling and thinking, oh, that's nice, and I don't get it, but... You know what? If you're kind of tracking with that and you want more information, I'd highly recommend Dr. Hartnett's book, his Starlight Time and the New Physics. It's a great one. There's another DVD that I think I brought some copies with me. This one here by Spike Saris, Our Created Solar System, Volume 1. And apparently he's going to do more volumes about other aspects. This one's on the solar system. And he does a fantastic job of just taking us kind of on a tour of the solar system. He starts with the sun, and then Mercury, and then Venus, and then Earth, and just goes on from there, and just detailing for every planet and many of the moons throughout the solar system how they could not possibly have come into existence via evolution and the Big Bang. It just doesn't work. It's a fantastic DVD. Creation Magazine often has articles on astronomy. We've got John Hartnett articles in there and so on. It's a fantastic magazine. I can't say enough about the magazine. 56 pages, full color. It's an attractive magazine. Exciting articles. It's not dry and boring science stuff. It's stuff that pertains to our faith. People get excited when they read the magazine. There's a children's section in the middle called Creation for Kids. There's no paid advertising. I mentioned this already on Wednesday. You know, most of the magazines you get nowadays, if it's a car magazine or a tractor magazine or whatever, it's 90% ads and 10% what you paid for in the first place. The Creation Magazine has no paid advertising because we want to fill every page with potentially faith-building information for the church. And that's I showed this again on Wednesday night. Here's what I believe the magazine does. It comes along and it answers those questions. There's an answer for that one, and the next issue comes along, there's an answer for that one, and on it goes. And if we're looking at the inside of one of our heads, for example, and we're struggling in our faith, we have all these unanswered questions, and can I really trust the Bible? What about this? What about this? What about this? The magazine comes in and removes all those questions. It answers those questions in a biblically sound and scientifically accurate manner. It's a fantastic magazine. I just encourage you to consider that again. And lots of books at the back on astronomy and some of these other things. So there's a kind of a whirlwind talk on astronomy. Yesterday was biology. What's tomorrow? Tomorrow's the age of the earth. Very controversial. So come back tomorrow. It's at 7. Is it 7 tomorrow? 7, not 7:30, right? It's 7 o'clock tomorrow, not 7:30. So if you come at 7:30, you'll miss the song. No, you'll miss more than that. But 7 o'clock tomorrow night, and we'll talk about the age of the earth. So that was astronomy. And as we, I said this when we started, I'm glad that we can do multiple sessions here. We started with an introduction, lay the groundwork, science versus faith, how do we understand how those fit together, and creation evolution. Then yesterday we looked at biology, and biology does not support evolution. We're told that it does, but it doesn't. When you look at the details of how life works at the genetic level, and that's what scientists are looking at nowadays, it doesn't fit with evolution. It fits with the Bible. Tonight we looked at the Big Bang, something that many people, even many Christians, feel is solid science. But it's not. At every stage of the supposed Big Bang story, it breaks down. And astronomers who work on the Big Bang are telling us that we really don't know how this happens. And yet in the textbooks and in the media, you hear that, oh yes, the Big Bang is good science. It's everybody believes it. That's just not the case. And tomorrow we'll look at some other things, and we'll look at geology when we talk about Noah's flood. Let's pray, and then we can be dismissed. Gracious God and Heavenly Father, we thank you for people like John Hartnett, who understand relativity better than just about anyone, and write books like Starlight Time and the New Physics that we can use to talk with people who've considered some of these problems in astronomy so significant that Christians would never be able to come up with an answer for these things, that the Bible must be wrong. Some people are so concerned that we're seeing the light from galaxies that are millions of light years away that they feel that the Bible can't be true, and therefore they reject Christ. Lord, we thank you for people like Dr. Hartnett who've taken it upon themselves to find answers to some of these big questions. And we just pray that you would equip us with even just a surface knowledge of some of these things so that we may share them with non-believers. And in that way, affect the world, the culture for you. And we pray that many people, as a result of those efforts, would hear the gospel and respond to it and become followers of your son, Jesus. In his name we pray. Amen. All right. Thanks again. And you're dismissed. We'll see you tomorrow night at 7:00.